welcome to the first ever episode of This Is Epigenetics, the bilingual podcast presented by Cirque Trainee Comedy, where we interview renowned Canadian scientists about their career, their research, and more importantly, their passion for epigenetics. In this week's episode, Alvin Chiu and myself, Benjamin Lebeau, interview Professor Martin Hurst, head of epigenomics at the University of British Columbia. We hope you will enjoy this discussion about single-cell genomics technology, database consolidation, and the benefits of breaking things apart.
Okay, so today we're speaking with Martin. Do you want to start with introducing yourself with a couple of sentences?
Yeah, my name is Martin Hurst, and I'm a professor in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology and Associate Director of the Michael Smith Lab at the University of British Columbia. And I work on epigenetics in its relationship to cancer. So we study epigenetic mechanisms and how they're deregulated in human cancers.
Well, thanks, Martin. And for the first question, what brought you to study science, epigenetic, and cancer?
Well, that's an excellent question.
Yeah.
I mean, I think for me, you know, ever since I was a child, I've been very curious about how things work. And as a younger man, you know, I took things apart all the time, constantly, and was very interested in how things mechanically worked, and then later how things worked biologically.
Yeah. So may I ask what type of things you're breaking down?
Yeah. So I would take apart my bicycle, for example. I would take the entire bicycle apart. I would take apart a toaster. If any appliance in the house broke, I would take it apart and try and figure out how it worked. And even when I was in graduate school and we had like a centrifuge break, I would take the centrifuge apart and try to fix it. And sometimes I was successful, but oftentimes I just ended up with a bunch of parts and I couldn't get it back together again. But I learned from that process. And so I think it's that curiosity of how things work that really brought me into science.
Yeah, and it's great that you're here at University of British Columbia, Martin. For the audience who doesn't know, I'm actually a student in your lab, but I don't know a lot about your own biographical history. So could you tell us about maybe originally where you're from and how you arrived here at UBC again?
Yeah, so I'm actually American by birth. I was born in Pennsylvania and spent most of my childhood actually traveling around the world. My father was a professor at Lehigh University and then subsequently took jobs in the oil industry. And that took us to Norway and to Scotland and to countries where I spent most of my youth. I did my undergraduate degree at UBC. And this is where I got interested actually in biology through my undergraduate program in biochemistry and molecular biology, which is where I got my PhD. I took an honors degree. And in my last year, I did an honors project with Dr. Ivan Sadowski. And at that time, I've learned about transcriptional regulation. So, you know, as you know, all of the cells in your body, for the most part, have the same genome. And yet those genomes are able to be read in various different ways. And one of the ways that those are read or how the genes are turned on and off is through transcription factors. And when I was in Ivan's lab, I, you know, first got my first taste of our understanding of how transcription factors turn genes on and off. And I was absolutely hooked.
Cool.
Yeah. So,
oh, no. Go.
You want me to keep going? I can keep going.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting. I studied a model organism called Saccharomyces cerevisiae, and we studied its response to galactose signaling. Chromatin was known at the time. So we knew that there were these things called histones and nucleosomes and that they were modified. But back in the mid 90s to the turn of the century, most of us in the transcriptional regulation field thought that this was just an unchanging, you know, structure of the genome, but not actively participating in transcriptional regulation. So it's quite interesting. I spent all of my PhD studying transcriptional regulation, but not thinking about epigenetic mechanisms at all.
And you are still doing that now. It's interesting that what you started to study as a student is now the focus of the research you're doing as an investigator.
In a sense, that's right. Although, of course, you know, my other interest, taking things apart and how they work, really was translated into technology. And I became very interested in technology very early on in my PhD. And actually in Ivan's lab, we had one of the first capillary sequencers at UBC. I started running one of those. And then I developed a technology for doing protein-protein interaction screenings using transcription factors. So there's this technology called Yeast2 Hybrid, which is a way of measuring proteins that interact with each other. But unfortunately, for transcription factors, which already activate expression, they can't be used. So we designed a technology that would allow you to study transcription factors that activate transcription in a two-hybrid system. And from that, we patented the technology, licensed the technology, and started a startup company, which was called Interomics Biopharmaceuticals.
That's actually quite an adventure as a PhD student and starting a company. So can you talk a bit about your career path from after your PhD, this company, and how you kind of pivoted back here into the academic world at UBC?
Yeah, it was quite a journey. Even my you know, final years of my PhD, I was pitching business models to investors in Canada, so banks and venture capitalists, and then was able to, you know, raise enough money to start the company, which we then leased space in Vancouver and started doing high throughput using robotic systems, these Yeast2 hybrid screens. So that's when I first got into bioinformatics through a collaboration with IBM. And we actually installed a little tiny cluster, which we called Microbe. It was only 3 nodes that allowed us to do the sequence similarity searching that we needed to do as part of this assay. And I got interested in bioinformatics, just basically trying to have to make it work, interested in how the Unix system operated, and did the sysadmin jobs and all the little jobs there. And, you know, my experience in industry, you know, gave me a perspective on how to do science that I think is quite distinct from the academic setting, you know, where you really have goals and timelines. And you really have to stay focused on those goals and timelines. Even if you find a finding that is intellectually very interesting, you kind of have to leave it on the cutting room floor. And that's challenging, but I think a great learning experience.
So is it why you went back to academia to be able to study what you wanted, even if it wouldn't in the short term lead to any financially viable insight?
Absolutely. So I think that is, you know, academia gives you that freedom to chase those ideas, to pivot in a minute. If you find you're following your hypothesis, but you might find a serendipitous finding that takes you in a completely different direction. And in academia, you have that freedom to chase those ideas. And so, you know, that was absolutely an attraction that brought me back into academia. And I came back through a position as a postdoctoral fellow under Marco Mara at Canada's Michael Smith Genome Sciences Center. And that's really where I kind of brought my industrial experience in terms of high throughput screening back into the academic setting and started working on some large collaborative international projects like the mammalian gene collection, and then later into epigenetics and in the International Human Epigenome Consortium.
Wow, yeah, that actually sounds really interesting to see how you've moved from, you know, being a graduate student to industry and then ultimately back to academia. I suppose a lot of our listeners here are potentially trainees, and people have this mindset that you can only pursue either a career in academia or industry, and it seems rather dichotomous. And so do you have any advice maybe to our listeners for someone who's open to the idea of both, or whether it's easy or difficult to transition between one and another and then transition back to the one you started with?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think historically, it certainly was true that there was this dichotomy between academia and industry, but I think that is largely broken down. In fact, you know, I think having that experience in industry coming out of your PhD, I think is an, you know, for those that are interested, I think provides a valuable experience in terms of how science is translated, and something that you can certainly build on as you, you know, if you move back or when you move back into an academic setting. And, you know, when I review CVs as part of my role at UBC, and certainly, you know, individuals who apply for academic positions that have industrial experience, if anything, that's considered an asset rather than anything else.
So that's pretty good to hear. I think that's really encouraging for a lot of the listeners who think that whatever you start off with, your career will be siloed into one portion or another. And it's great to know that actually, in fact, that as you build on various experiences, it's actually viewed positively and it's valued by members in industry or academia as well. One of the things we like to do with all of our guests is we want to know a bit about them outside of science. And so you talked about building things and putting them together. Is that something you still do? And what other things do you kind of do with your free time nowadays?
Yeah, so I still enjoy building things, but now I build things that you can, you know, exist within. So I you know, I've always loved to be in nature. And so I spend a lot of time outdoors and I like to build things. Myself and two of my very close friends, we purchased a piece of property way up north and actually built a cabin on site using wood that was milled on the site and built it together. And so, you know, those activities I really enjoy and I still do that. So I like to be outside. I like to build and I like to garden. I'm never happier than when I'm in a forest. I find that to be very comforting and soothing for me. I like to hike and enjoy what the West Coast has to offer.
Since you like the outside and the forest, have you ever thought to study plants or trees in your projects?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So I have not actually. You know, I've never studied plants. I find them to be very intriguing, of course. But yeah, that's interesting. I've never thought about studying their transcriptional states. That's for sure. Yeah.
And maybe something I'll add in here that I find kind of quite interesting is physically in the lab, we're located beside other labs that study plant models. And so right beside Martin's office is actually a small green room where a neighboring lab is growing plants. And so potentially all the plant stuff is percolating through the air and making its way not only into the lab, but into your free time as well.
That's an excellent point.
Well, I think this mix of plant and science is a nice way to segue to speaking about science.
Right.
So you said that you were interested in bioinformatics. You work and manage a lot of the data sets that are available online. So how hard is it to get everybody to share their data, either across the country or across the world, and to share it in a way that everybody can use and understand? Is it challenging?
Yeah, I think it's one of the major challenges that our field faces at this time. And especially in the context of human subject data, which is most of the types of data that we work with, which is epigenetic measurements that are made on primary human subject, either cells or tissues. And these data, by their nature, need to be deposited into restricted or protected repositories. Of course, there is no repository for this data in Canada. And so we are reliant upon the United States or our European partners to deposit this data. The challenge comes in actually once the data is deposited, and if you wanted to do, or if you were interested in doing a large scale meta-analysis of such data, essentially sequence-based data that exists in these repositories, it is enormously challenging to get this data back out again, number one. And number two is just the annotation that comes along with the data. So we call that annotation metadata, which tells us something about what this data is. If it's sequence data, let's say it's a ChIP-seq experiment, it tells us something about the ChIP-seq, what kind of antibody it was, you know, what the tissue is, and this kind of essential information. In the field right now, that information is stored in non-standard ways. It's stored in different fields within the data structure itself. And even within the same field, the language that's used is not controlled. So people are, you know, so individual researchers will code the same type of data slightly differently. And then, you know, when you come to do a meta-analysis, these are, you know, become major challenges as you try to traverse across multiple data sets and combine them in a way that, you know, will allow you to do your analysis.
And is there a movement now to try to normalize the data sets that are stored?
Yeah. So, you know, as I mentioned, you know, when I, you know, I've been part of what is known as the International Human Epigenome Consortium, and was actually lucky enough to be part of the one of the founding consortia, which was the NIH Roadmap Program. Within the context of both the Roadmap, ENCODE, and the other partners, including the Canadian partner, the Canadian Epigenetics and Environment Health Research Consortium, we have been developing metadata standards to allow for exactly this kind of data transfer and interoperability. And we have done this through a structured database that's housed within the EBI, so the European Bioinformatics Institute. And this provides a standard structure to submit epigenetic data into these repositories. In the context of the International Human Epigenome Consortium, we've also developed a series of containers. So these are essentially analytical pipeline packages that are put together that allow you to reprocess existing data using the current algorithms or analytical workflows, which then allow you to compare to more contemporary data sets. Of course, we're still challenged by the biases of the changing sequencing technologies, which of course have rapidly advanced in the last 10 years. And for those challenges, that really has to be done post hoc in terms of after the analysis. So those packages are there to help alleviate some of those biases that exist in older data sets.
So if all the data sets were to be standardized and easy to access, what would be the benefits for science and healthcare in general?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. I mean, just from the research enterprise perspective, it allows researchers to reuse data sets and to ask questions of the data sets in new ways. As we learn new ways that a cell might be regulated or a new epigenetic state, by having a consistent repository with well-annotated and universal metadata, it allows that data reuse in that context.
So do you think there are specific challenges to epigenetics, the data collection and data sharing compared to other fields where maybe the technology is more, older and well-established? Is that something unique to epigenetics, that the technology is rapidly changing or newer assays are being developed?
Yeah, so I think there are some unique challenges to epigenetics versus, let's take the sister technology, just genome sequencing. I mean, genome sequencing itself has lots of similar challenges in terms of data sharing, data reuse, data protections. These are similar challenges. But on top of that, epigenetics has the added challenge of the myriad of different types of technologies that are used. So remember, the output for the most part in epigenetics or epigenomic measurements is sequence-based, but the molecular biology that occurs upstream can be very different. And there are different biases depending on how you do, whatever, assay it is that you're applying to a given chromatin state to be able to measure it by sequencing. So that is a challenge in and itself. And then I would say the added challenge is that, of course, the epigenetic state or the functional state of the genome is influenced by the environment. We know this. However, how do you capture that information in the context of these repositories, I think is another challenge. So we have this sort of added challenge of being able to collate all of the environmental information that might be relevant for a given data set to be able to fully interpret it in a standardized way, in addition to the assays, and then, of course, all of the fundamental issues with sharing human subject sequence data.
Great. A lot of our listeners are probably very familiar with various epigenetic assays, but could you maybe give an example of what you just mentioned, where while the sequencing might be similar, that the pre-sequencing, so the library generation, or even how the biological handling of the samples and how the assay is performed in the wet lab, how that's evolved and which kind of represents a more real state or real epigenetic state of the cells being profiled?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I'll use ChIP-seq as an example. ChIP-seq was one of the first technologies that was actually used on next generation sequencing or massively parallel sequencing, because at the time the read lengths were short. And this was a technology that in fact got me hooked into epigenetics to begin with, is because for the first time we could actually measure histone occupancies genome-wide. So in the initial, you know, initial versions of chip sequencing, these were formamide cross-linked based technologies where we were sequencing maybe 10 million reads if we were lucky. Current technologies include things like MNAs, so an enzymatic digested chromatin, and sequencing depths of between 50 and 100 million paired end reads, remembering the first technologies were single end reads. And then, of course, you know, the whole cut and run. So using various other strategies to incorporate adapters into the chromatin prior to immunoprecipitation. So, you know, there are major technological changes that have occurred in the last decade in how we measure chromatin states. And these have sensitivity and specificity differences, which then impact our ability to do any kind of meta-analysis.
And as a follow-up to that, what do you think is the biggest change in the field in the last 5 years, either in terms of how an assay evolved or any new assays?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we can all agree that one of the biggest changes that's occurred in the last 5 years, maybe a little bit more, but last 5 years is really our ability to measure these molecular features at a single cell level. That technology is still rapidly advancing, and I think sensitivity is still a major challenge. So stochastic data loss of any of the single cell technologies is still very challenging. But even using cut and tag strategies, you know, we are seeing the first, let's stay with chip sequencing, the first chip sequencing data sets coming out. You know, obviously, again, sensitivity is a challenge, but I would say that's one of the major, advancements in our field in the last 5 years.
Indeed, the advent of single cell sequencing was a big step forward for the field. Could you expand on the benefits of doing your sequencing in single cell?
So, excellent question. So, of course, the fundamental unit of an organism is the cell. And so we know that the cell is, you know, is the unit that we must study to be able to understand, to fully understand the complexity of a given tissue organism or cell type. So, you know, fundamentally we are, you know, constructed of cells. And so just from that perspective, you know, it's important that we study it that way. Now, as you pointed out, you know, the drawback is that we lose sensitivity. And so we're not able to measure all the features. In fact, we don't know how many of the features we're able to measure. And so I think as we move into this field, I think it's so essential that we have the foundation of the bulk sequencing of where we're looking at hundreds or thousands of cells as a comparator, and then overlaying that single cell information so that we have an understanding of what the full scope of, at least given our current technologies, a particular epigenetic feature is, and then understanding the underlying heterogeneity within individual cells. And just to add to that, of course, you know, what we define as being a cell, you know, historically has been defined by its morphological appearance, its, you know, cell surface markers that we might attribute to some functional state. But we know through single cell technologies that that's an imperfect classification system. And so the other advantage of single cell analysis is that we're able to actually measure individual cells and really for the first time, you know, understand at a molecular level what the underlying heterogeneity and distribution is of a feature amongst cells that may be, you know, morphologically similar.
So kind of thinking about the evolution of technology and then relating this back to the ChIP-seq example we've been using, we started off with talking about cross-linked ChIP-seq and how the technology has improved through using MNAs for native ChIP-seq and then cut and run and cut and tag. And then the next step has been shrinking down to smaller and smaller inputs so that we can understand it at the single cell. Now that we're at a single cell level, where do you think the field is moving? We can't get any smaller than breaking the cell down. So what is next for these technologies?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that we still have a long way to go in terms of sensitivity at the single cell level. So I think that the technology will continue to evolve in that way. But if I may pivot, you know, what I see in the next 10 years is as being, you know, the next technology is in our ability to edit the epigenome. So to be able to perturb the epigenome. And of course, we've seen the beginnings of those technologies where we're harnessing CRISPR-based strategies to guide epigenetic modifying enzymes to particular regions of the genome. at a very low scale. But to be able to do that, you know, at a genome-wide scale in a single cell, in other words, to be able to convert a epigenetic state of a primordial cell or a, you know, a progenitor cell, let's say a hematopoietic stem cell, and to be able to imprint upon that genome the epigenetic state of a T cell, will have, I think, profound implications in terms of regenerative medicine and how we conduct in vitro differentiation studies. You know, it's fascinating that, you know, we can take a fully differentiated cell and, you know, adding the Yamamaka factors, we can, you know, reprogram that cell back into an induced pluripotent state. But that process is extremely inefficient. And it's likely extremely inefficient because the chromatin state is resistant to this reprogramming. So if we can combine, you know, our ability to reprogram the epigenome at a single cell level, so not just at one site, but at multiple, maybe hundreds or thousands of regulatory sites genome-wide in one go, I think that has the potential to revolutionize the way we design and the way we perform in vitro differentiation experiments. And that's going to revolutionize regenerative medicine and many aspects of our field.
Wow. So that would be a way to turn any specific cells into any other cells.
Absolutely. And of course, we're already doing that in vitro differentiation reactions. As you know, we can take human embryonic stem cells and we can make them into, you know, pancreatic cells. We can make them into neural cells. But that process is inefficient, arguably, could be made more efficient and more relevant by combining those biochemical conditions and cytokine conditions with reprogramming of the epigenetic state.
So it sounds like you're very interested, obviously, in epigenetics itself. A lot of what you've talked about centers around human health. And so I'm sure a lot of our listeners are really interested to see or learn about how you apply epigenetics in your own research. So do you want to start off with letting us know a bit about your own research and how epigenetics has played a role in maybe human health or human disease?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. So in our lab, you know, we focus our research in trying to understand cancer. The types of cancers we study are those that epigenetic dysfunction appears to play a major role. And so, for example, we study rare forms of sarcoma, where the only alteration that can be found, and these are genetic alterations, occur to epigenetic modifiers. So oftentimes these are enzymes or these are proteins that are part of complexes that are involved in placing or moving nucleosomes. And the complex that does that is the Sui-SNF complex or the BAF complex. And there are a number of rare pediatric sarcomas that the only mutation we can find in the genome impacts one or more of the complex members of the Sui-SNF complex.
So you've mentioned some of the sarcomas, which are quite rare. Are there other cancers that your research group is studying currently?
Yeah, so you know, that's one of the, I would argue, one of the major accomplishments and findings of the last decade of sequencing cancer genomes, is that in addition to the, you know, rare sarcomas that have these, you know, seemingly pathognomonic changes that impact the Sui-SNF complex, there are also more common cancers and adult cancers that appear to be driven by epigenetic mechanisms. And one of those cancers that we study in the lab is leukemia. Leukemia is, you know, an interesting cancer in the sense that there are highly recurrent mutations to a class of epigenetic modifiers that's involved in maintaining DNA methylation homeostasis. So both the enzymes that write DNA methylation, so the DMTs, so DMT3A, for example, and the enzymes that erase it, the TETs, are recurrent targets in human leukemias, suggesting that these play a role in establishing a state that allows the leukemia to proliferate.
That's interesting, because since both enzymes that deposits or remove the methylation of DNA are mutated in the same type of cancer, how can you inhibit or block one without causing the phenotype that would happen when the other is mutated?
I mean, that's an excellent question. And so, you know, maybe I can just add a little bit more context. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating that these same mutations that occur to the DNA methylation machinery appear to occur very early on in pre-leukemic states in the context of clonal hemopoiesis of indeterminate potential. So these are, even in asymptomatic individuals, we can find evidence of these mutations occurring, and they appear to occur very early on. And that's one of the, you know, seems to be a common feature of these genetic lesions to epigenetic modifiers, that they occur early in the, you know, even in a pre-malignant state, and set up the landscape for transformation. And in the context of leukemia, we believe that they play a role in actually altering the transcriptional state to block differentiation. Of course, leukemia is a type of cancer that's defined by a differentiation block, where the cells accumulate at some state in the differentiation hierarchy, but are unable to complete the differentiation process into a functional cell type. And we believe that this alteration in DNA methylation, both gains and losses, help to block differentiation. And so to answer the question, you know, I think it really becomes context specific. So it depends on where in the genome you target.
So with the future techniques that you talked about that can edit the epigenome at specific place, that'll be a great help for that type of cancer or any type of cancer that depends on a prepping of their epigenetic landscape.
Yeah. And so, you know, in the context of leukemia, for example, you know, what our research and other research has shown is that gains of methylation appear to occur within the regulatory elements that we call enhancers. And so enhancers are elements in the genome that are bound by transcription factors and then turn genes on. And what we believe is that DNA methylation, aberrant DNA methylation, blocks the ability of some transcription factors to be recruited to these elements, and in that way then blocks differentiation. And so, you know, metabolic changes in the cell can be triggered that would drive DNA hypomethylation potentially, genome-wide, or certainly at these particular regulatory elements. One of the areas that we've been studying in particular is an essential nutrient, vitamin C, which appears to be able to activate the TET enzymes. The TET enzymes are part of a family of enzymes called dioxygenases, and vitamin C is able to activate these dioxygenases. And so, you know, one of our therapeutic, you know, theories is that potentially vitamin C or an analog like vitamin C could be used to specifically activate the TET enzymes in the context of these regulatory elements that are blocked by DNA methylation, leading to their hypomethylation and then recruitment of transcription factors and then relieving the differentiation block.
I just wanted to go back to something Ben had mentioned earlier, and it ties in with what you've mentioned in terms of in these cancers, in particular leukemia, but also in other cancers, there are regions in the genome, whether it be enhancers or other regulatory regions, that gain or lose methylation, for instance. Currently, various groups or even clinicians are using DNA hypomethylating agents. As we know, these agents don't say, I'm going to demethylate this region of the genome and not this region of the genome. So what sort of overarching thoughts do you have about the idea where a lot of the inhibitors, they don't necessarily target specific regions in the genome, but rather they're just blanketing something with overall either increasing or decreasing methylation, and it's not necessarily in the specific regions that drive, you know, genes of interest that we're currently studying?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. Of course, you know, therapeutically, DNA methylation inhibitors, so 5-azacitidine or DAC, are actually used clinically in the context of pre-malignant states and even leukemia, with the hope that a global hypomethylation may in fact lead to some regulatory state change that would have therapeutic benefit. And that appears to be true, at least for, you know, some patients, which, you know, which show some therapeutic benefit from these genome-wide DNA methylation inhibitors. But of course, you know, it's quite controversial in the sense that we know that DNA methylation plays an important role in regulating other elements in the genome that are detrimental to the cell, for example, endogenous retroviruses. And so, you know, certainly, you know, there is evidence that the activity of these inhibitors will lead to potentially off-target effects that are not, you know, would not be therapeutically beneficial.
Okay, so thanks for talking about that. It sounds that These agents, they do hypomethylate certain regions, but obviously they might be hypomethylating regions in which cells require some level of DNA methylation. So there could be undesirable effects from that. I did want to actually go back to something you mentioned a bit earlier. And it was actually when you were describing the disease you studied, you say, you know, there are these rare sarcomas, and then there are also these more common diseases like leukemia. I know I get asked this quite a lot in my, when I do presentations, but people have this tendency to think, oh, something is rare, therefore it's not as valuable to study. What can you say, or how, what would you comment if someone told you that about this rare sarcomas that we study?
I think it's important to realize that BAF complex mutations, or mutations to Swi-SNF complex members, actually occur in 20% of all human cancers. So that certainly isn't rare. And oftentimes, and this is, you know, certainly true historically, that advancements in our understanding come from studying the rare forms where we have extreme examples of a particular event. And by studying them in the context of their rare forms, where the mutation itself is isolated from other confounding variables, we can learn why these mutations are being selected for, learn how to treat those, or how to alter those states. And so I think by studying these rare cancers, not only do we benefit those patients who are suffering from these rare malignancies, but it also provides foundation to learn more about how these mutations are being selected for in the more common cancer types.
Yeah, because better cures are built on better understanding of the disease. So even if the model is rare, the insight we get from it is valuable for everyone.
Absolutely. And you know, some mechanistic understanding of how these mutations are arising. I mean, when you think about it, you know, for a minute, you have these biallelic, so both alleles of a particular Swi-SNF complex, let's take, for example, rhabdoid tumors, which, you know, is a pediatric tumor that involves biallelic loss of SMARCB1, a component of the Swi-SNF complex. So somehow during development, this biallelic loss is A, occurring, and B, is being selected for as some kind of selective advantage for that particular cell where that genetic lesion occurs. And we have no understanding of A, how that happens, how the cell survives without this, you know, essential component of the Swi-SNF complex. And then not only that, how that provides that cell with a selective advantage that allows it to, you know, eventually, unfortunately, transform into a malignancy. So, you know, I think absolutely by studying the mechanism by which these rare tumors form, you know, that's going to inform us in terms of how these mutations are being selected in more common cancer types, and hopefully, you know, provide some new knowledge in how we could therapeutically target them.
Great. Thanks for that. Yeah, I think that really answers some of the questions our skeptics have, that in fact, a disproportionate amount of information in biology has been gained from studying rare diseases because they occur in a more clean or pure form where we have just single mutations, so they're easiest to study. So as we're wrapping up,
you said that much better than I. says a lot. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, I think it's maybe just because I tend to start off presentations saying, "Oh, I study a rare disease, a rare sarcoma," and instantly I'm bombarded with these questions about, "Oh, it's rare. If so few people have it, why are we studying this?" And what people don't realize that in fact a lot of stuff has been learned from rare diseases. So in our concluding minutes, do you have any final words you want to leave the audience with?
Any words of wisdom?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, my mantra in the lab is the devil's in the details. The details matter. And so my piece of advice for graduate students and trainees as you're working through your journey in your thesis is really to pay attention to the details. Don't assume anything, and learn as much as you can about the processes, whether they be molecular, whether they be at the organism scale, or whether they be computational. The details are what matter, and the science is in the details, and the knowledge is in the details. So that would be my concluding statement.
Thank you for listening to the first ever episode of This is Epigenetics. If you like this episode, don't forget to visit our website for more informative content about epigenetics. And stay tuned for next episode where we'll interview, in French, Dr. Mathieu Lupien.